in some ways it's a huge benefit, the incumbency. In other ways, it adds to the stress because you realise what you have to lose.
When you're in government, your campaigning is really about trying to explain to people what you've done and why it was good and why you need to carry on doing it.
Hello and welcome to Preparing for Power, a special Inside Briefing podcast brought to you by the Institute for Government. The days, weeks and months ahead are going to be dominated by opinion polls and campaign slogans, policy pledges and manifesto launches. But what about the morning after election night? Whoever forms the next government will need to be prepared, and the job begins almost as soon as the votes have been counted. So what is it like to go from opposition to government overnight? How do civil servants get ready for the possibility of a transition of power or a hung parliament? And what is it like for a governing party to continue in power after a bruising campaign? Over the next 6 weeks, the Institute for Government will be taking you behind the scenes to find out how our politicians, advisers and officials block out the noise of a general election campaign to get ready for being in government. We'll be speaking to former ministers, special advisers and senior civil servants to discover how they prepared for that all-important election result, to hear their secrets and to work out the lessons for 2024. I'm Catherine Haddon, Programme Director at the Institute for Government. In this episode, we'll be looking at how governing parties prepare for an election. For the party in government, an election is a mandate on their time in office, a chance to fight for continuing to deliver on their priorities, and the difference between being in power or being kicked out. And the governing party has many benefits before the election. It can choose the date of an election, it has the means to set the political agenda in the months before a campaign, and it has access to the civil service, an advantage when contemplating future policy plans. But the electoral prospects facing the governing party can be very different depending on how the government is faring. Being ahead in the polls, approaching a potential second term, is very different from being behind in the polls after more than a decade in power.
I think it's typically the case that third-term governments face quite a problem.
Oliver Letwin was a key figure in the Conservative Party's preparation for the 2015 election. For him, one of the biggest challenges facing governments that have been in power for three or more terms is the difficulty in refreshing policy ideas and the brand.
While 5 years, is four or five years in our case, five, is often too short to finish implementing a programme that has already been set going, and so it was in our case, we were still, as I say, in media raid so far as the programme was concerned. 10 years is probably long enough to have done everything, but you started 10 years back trying to do, and the situation will have changed so significantly over the 10-year period that you probably need to start fresh, thinking undoubtedly in principle along the same lines, but nevertheless, in changed circumstances and after much water has flown under many bridges, you really got to start again. And it's very difficult, I think, typically, for governments to do that. I've never had that experience because I didn't get to the 10-year point, but I'm sure that even if Brexit hadn't intervened and all the things that had happened, I think it would be difficult a third time.
Former head of the Treasury, Nick Macpherson, also remembers the feeling in 2015 being quite positive as the Conservatives faced a possible second term.
I think there was quite a high tempo, partly because George Osborne was working on the assumption that he was going to win and would come back, and therefore was already thinking about what would happen in the next parliament, rather like, you know, Nigel Lawson was back in 87.
Gus O'Donnell was cabinet secretary for the 2010 election when Gordon Brown faced a resurgent Conservative Party after 13 years of Labour governments. O'Donnell knew from experience that whatever the polls may say, the civil service has to be as prepared for the governing party returning as for any other scenario. Not least because the party in government are still their masters and will expect officials not to give up on their prospects.
The most important thing, first of all, is that you get it across to everybody not to make assumptions. It's very easy, particularly if one party is a long way ahead in the polls, to think that, right, that's what we've got to prepare for. I mean, I lived through the 1992 election. I was there when the polls were saying that Labour would win. The exit polls even were saying that Labour would win and John Major returned as Prime Minister. do not prejudge things, right? Be sure you're a good Boy Scout and you're prepared for all possible outcomes. So that's the number one thing. And then you have to think about how you would operate in all of the different scenarios. So the government of the day winning is the easiest, obviously. I mean, you know, you've got the same people, but there are challenges because the Prime Minister might want to start with a new cabinet. They might want to have a reshuffle straight away. If they've got a big majority, they might want to do something they hadn't expected, you know, hadn't planned on.
As the governing party approach the election, it is also dealing with the day-to-day running of government. Major domestic and international events will shape how all parties approach an election, but are particularly significant for the government. Harriet Harman was a cabinet minister ahead of the 2010 election.
What the whole government was focused on was ensuring that it didn't turn into a global depression and trying to protect people through it and after it. So actually, there were contrast at that point between opposition, who had no responsibility at all, and us, who were dealing with the global forces that was affecting every single people's lives. I mean, there could hardly have been a greater contrast there. But when you're in government, your campaigning is really about trying to explain to people what you've done and why it was good and why you need to carry on doing it.
While campaigning as the governing party has its challenges, there are many benefits for the incumbent. One particular factor is control over timing and, in the lead up to an election, the ability to try and set the agenda.
The governing party has a lot of power to set the agenda, and that is principally because it can do things.
Alex Thomas is a programme director at the Institute for Governments and a former civil servant.
So, you know, by definition, the government is governing. They can introduce legislation. They can schedule a budget. The Prime Minister is constantly out there domestically and internationally doing things. And so by doing things, they then force the media, the opposition, the commentariat to react to those things. So that is probably the single biggest advantage that a government has in terms of framing its election campaign. And so as you get closer to the election, the things that the government does will be pursued more with that framing of the election in mind. And then you can dig into that a little bit more. So, for example, to take the budget and the fiscal rules and what the government spends, the government has this enormous power in that they can announce a spending commitment and then that's on the books. So we're seeing this debate at the moment between the Conservative Party and the Labour Party about what's affordable or not. The government has got a much easier starting point there because they can set the terms of that debate and then immediately push it back onto the opposition to say, well, how would you afford X, Y, or Z? So there are sort of micro things that the government has resources of civil servants. It can, you know, has certain venues that it can use. The Prime Minister can stand on the tarmac in Downing Street and kind of make announcements. But those pale into insignificance, I think, beyond that power of setting the agenda.
As the election approaches, the governing party will ramp up its political operation. They will bring in campaign specialists, a team to develop the manifesto, and increasingly dispatch the Prime Minister or other key ministers around the country long before the formal campaign period begins. Kate Fall, now Baroness Fall, was David Cameron's Deputy Chief of Staff in Downing Street. We asked her how the Conservative Party started preparing for the 2015 general election.
You have to start a parallel operation. I mean, we had hired Linton Crosby, I think, maybe 2013 at the beginning of that year to come in and start thinking about the campaign properly. We started having some more political meetings where there were no officials in the room, where we were thinking about the campaign, thinking about the policy side. Of course, the Prime Minister had to go and do all the sort of looking at the marginal seats and where should I get you to on Fridays or Thursdays and Fridays up and down the country, raising money, all that side of things. So you're really ramping up the political side, making sure you've got candidates in the seat, tying them in CCHQ. That sort of gears up on the second-hand side of the parliament. And the political team, we'd start meeting Sunday nights. That was always a meeting. We would start coming into campaign. I look back now and think, Sunday nights? yeah, we'd always come together on a Sunday night because it was just out of the framework of the normal sort of running of the country during the week. And we would sit and sort of go through the ground plan, the air campaign, and just make sure we were up to speed and anything.
The looming election also means a change in the close working relationship in government between the political team of ministers and special advisers and the civil servants who support them.
you come in and you sort of get to know each other and you work really smoothly. And then there's a weird moment when you realise that you're the ones fighting for your job there, and they're sort of going back to their desk, which is, again, it is a sort of interesting experience. But, you know, that's the system.
Some ministers will want to use this time to push through the policies they care most about. And some may also have one eye on the legacy they want to leave behind. In 2010, Labour had been in power for over a decade. As the election approached, Harriet Harman became more focused on what she wanted to achieve.
I was very keen to get through the Equality Act, and that had been in the manifesto in 2005. And I took over the equality role in 2007, and nothing had happened on it. And it was like, oh, we're heading to an election soon. I better crack on with this. And of course, it involved conflict with every other government department. Everybody had a really good reason why they didn't want this chunk, that chunk, and the other chunk. So the clock was really against us on that. And we had various ministerial meetings of junior ministers getting together across the departments, and each one would come along with a veto, and we'd get nowhere. And actually, my special advisor, Aisha Hazarika, said, you know, we are running out of time here, and unless you get Gordon to just tell them all they've got to do it, it's not going to happen, and we're just going to be timed out. So, you know, we arranged a meeting. I went in and I said to Gordon, we have got to get this done before the election. And I thought he would have in his mind all the other departments with their fabulous reasons about why this should not happen. But actually he said, yep, we're going to do it.
An approaching election can also exacerbate political divisions. In the run-up to the 2015 election, former Liberal Democrat adviser Polly McKenzie saw dividing lines deepen between the Conservative and Liberal Democrat parties.
Politics is politics, right? Like, most careers end in disgrace or failure of some kind. I think that the AV referendum had been such a turning point in which, you know, David Cameron, who had said he would stay out of that debate, had then not just campaigned to keep first past the post, fine, fair enough, but actually, you know, he and his party had financially supported and then delivered literature through every door in the House saying that Nick Clegg had betrayed the country by supporting the Conservatives. I mean, that is politics. It is brutal. But if we wonder why the country isn't perhaps thriving in the way that it should, it's partly because all of the incentives of our political system are to brutalise your enemies, no matter how many people voted for them, no matter who they represent and what constituency and ideas they stand for. And so we end up with politics that just tears itself to pieces. But no, it's a bit depressing, isn't it?
As well as choosing the date of the election and some greater control over key events and political moments leading up to an election, there are other incumbency benefits for the governing party. One is how the governing party can use official resources. Civil servants don't work on manifestos or directly develop policies for them, but they are constantly helping to provide advice for future policies that the government might be thinking about. This, of course, can feed into the work that the political party is doing in developing its manifesto.
Like so much of the British system, the dividing line between what civil servants can and can't work on in terms of developing parties' manifestos is not particularly clear-cut.
Here's the IFG's Alex Thomas.
Obviously, at one extreme, a civil servant would absolutely not be working on the text of the manifesto or helping actually kind of produce the thing. But clearly, quite a lot of the thinking that happens within government, including from civil servants, then goes on to inform what a political party might stand on at a forthcoming election. And the closer you get to that election, the less likely it is the government can implement whatever policy you're talking about in the remainder of its term, and the more likely that becomes a manifesto thing. Civil servants aren't kind of naive to that. They know that the work that they're producing, as long as it's at the instruction of ministers, is likely to go and inform the manifesto. In fact, quite often civil servants quite like that, not just because it means they get to shape some of the policy development, but more importantly, because it means that policies that are in the manifesto are then based on, hopefully, decent advice, decent evidence, and a good grounding. I don't think there's anything sort of constitutionally improper with that, as long as it's a policy development that's done in government, in good faith, under the authority of ministers. If that, is then translated into a manifesto, so be it. it can sometimes, though, go wrong. The most obvious example is that Theresa May, when she came into government in 2016, had kicked off some work with civil servants and special advisors working on social care, which were then translated into the 2017 election campaign with what were generally considered to be disastrous consequences, with Theresa May doing a U-turn on the policy while claiming that she hadn't done a U-turn, and supposedly on the doorsteps, politicians seem to think that that lost the Conservative Party a fair bit of support that led to them losing their majority in 2017. So, you know, it's good that policies are grounded in civil service advice and evidence, but they still do need to be kind of given the political once-over as well, clearly.
Oliver Letwin thinks that this civil service role is of limited value and argues that only politicians and their political advisers can develop the retail offer to the electorate.
The civil service, which if used appropriately and if it has the right relationships with government, is incredibly useful as a device for turning policy ideas formulated in opposition into realizable, more sensible, more practical policy. It's not very good at helping people to formulate political positions because it's not a group of politicians. It has a different function.
For Polly McKenzie, the benefit of the civil service was clearer, particularly when the Liberal Democrats felt the lack of this support.
Traditionally, the government always has access to the civil service to think about what it might want to do over a 5, 10, 15-year time horizon, and they end up using that to write their manifesto if they are a governing party. And the opposition has short money to help it do the policy development. As the Liberal Democrats, we only had, in theory, access to the departments that we ran. And so we had to fight quite hard to be able to commission a separate and additional policy advice. And we ended up getting quite a lot of that, quite extensive notes, including on the tax implications of legalising cannabis, which was a fascinating paper.
Nick McPherson saw it differently. As permanent secretary at the Treasury, he would provide official advice to both the Conservative Chancellor, George Osborne, and to Danny Alexander, the Lib Dem minister in the department.
My recollection is that generally we tried to give Tory ministers and Liberal ministers the same advice. But we also, to make the coalition work, we also created safe spaces where, within manageable proportions, they could ask specifically for advice on things which would just go to them. And Danny Alexander certainly made use of that. I mean, obviously, when the election was called, you can't continue to give advice on development of policy. But it wouldn't surprise me, and I really can't remember because it's now some time ago, that in 2014, he may have asked for advice on certain policies which might have been part of the Liberal agenda had they remained in government.
But as Polly McKenzie points out, different levels of access to advice from officials risked exacerbating the differences between the two parties, particularly as they were starting to consider how to campaign against each other. The Lib Dems did more to try and differentiate themselves and their role inside government.
In a way, you're starting to govern in a way that is setting you up for an election conversation rather than just in the service of the country. And that's always, you know, a bit difficult. For example, there was a big debate around childcare in the budget just before the 2015 general election. And so in the end, we had to separate. And Danny Alexander ended up doing a yellow budget. We got a yellow budget box commissioned, which was slightly embarrassing. But still, recognising the kind of constitutional difficulties, because George Osborne was announcing a policy which wasn't going to happen unless they won the election. So why couldn't we do that? And it was, I don't know, it felt horrible for me, certainly, and I'm sure lots of my colleagues who really just wanted to use these last moments to try and keep governing well, that it just became much more of a political game. And of course, a political game that we lost quite badly.
When the campaign formally starts, the attention of ministers shifts from the day job of being in government. They are not just campaigning for the party as a whole, they're also campaigning to win their own seats. Some will have safer majorities than others.
The day-to-day role of ministers during an election campaign is, you know, clearly more limited than when you're outside of the campaign, just because they have far less time to make policy decisions, to, you know, take advice, to have meetings and so on. So they are in the department much less. There will probably be a duty minister day by day, week by week, who's keeping a general oversight on the department that things are ticking over. But most of the ministers, most of the politicians will be out on the campaign trail, because during the campaign, clearly the thing that matters most to them, understandably, is giving their best shot at winning the election. Things can happen, though, clearly, you know, floods, crises, terrorist attacks. We've experienced all of those in different ways in election campaigns in the past. And that means that ministers have to scramble, come back off the campaign trail, come into the department. And obviously then they're making decisions in the particularly charged environment of an election campaign. It also means that Parliament isn't there. So there's, you know, it is quite different. It's not just that Parliament isn't around, it doesn't actually exist. So you have this quite, you know, unusual situation, whereas if you did need to legislate, you wouldn't be able to. So it changes the context if you're in an emergency.
Civil service rules mean that any support they provide to ministers must be kept separate from the campaign. And a lot of the work of departments is put on hold during the election. They still have to keep the minister informed and make sure urgent decisions are made, but they must draw clear lines between that responsibility and the campaign itself.
All things being well, the department would quiet down. You're in a kind of care and maintenance basis. But it is, of course, worth saying that the vast majority of the civil service working on operational and delivery matters carries on doing what they're doing. They wouldn't normally see a minister from one month to the next anyway. And so they're still, you know, continuing to deliver public services and so on. So we are talking about the kind of heart of Whitehall rather than the whole of the 500,000 civil service or the wider kind of public sector. The one bit of the civil service that really does kick into gear is the propriety and ethics team. And that's because most ministers have a fairly good sense of what the line is and that you shouldn't be using public resources for political purposes. But obviously, the line is, you know, in their minds, perhaps more blurred than it is in those of the civil servants advising them. So it may be that they think, you know, it's okay to hold a meeting somewhere that might be interpreted as a marginal seat, or they want to, you know, have an event that they think is a government event, but actually could be seen through the prism of the campaign as giving an advantage to one political party or the others.
Not all ministers will be called upon to take a high-profile role during the campaign. Before the 2015 election, Oliver Letwin was involved in thinking through what might happen if the Conservatives failed to win a majority and were facing a coalition or similar agreement. But during the campaign, he largely focused on what was going on in government while the Prime Minister and others were elsewhere.
I was involved really exclusively at that time in trying to make sure that the government continued to run right up to the day rather than concerning myself with the election itself. And needless to say, the amount of attention that the Prime Minister and the people who are going to front the general election, in particular George Osborne helping the Prime Minister, were able to devote to the running government diminished as they went into the middle of this very vigorous election. So actually, I found myself more involved in the mechanics of running government in those days, just keeping the show on the road while the election campaign was being fought.
Polly McKenzie had a similar experience in her role as a special advisor to Nick Clegg.
My role during that election was, obviously in retrospect, a slightly pointless one, but I actually stayed in government to pick up any crises that might occur, which was hardly any, but you never know. There's, you never know when there's going to be a pandemic disease or a flood or something, but also to continue actually preparing for coalition talks. And so as the manifestos came out, doing that analytical work about where there was alignment, where there wasn't. And so I ended up having various conversations with different civil service teams about those exciting topics.
Like Oliver Letwin, Polly McKenzie was also preparing for the possibility of another hung parliament.
I was geared up. I'm still hyper prepared. Obviously, we had in 2010 been what we thought was prepared. And then when you go into it, you realize you haven't got a clue how to be in government. After 5 years, we were, I think, incredibly capable. And we also knew how to approach a negotiation. So, yes, I had a lot of work that we had done about where the alignments were, where the disagreements were, but also where the kind of the operational risks would be.
As well as preparing for the election result, both civil servants and ministers have to be prepared for whatever might happen during the election campaign itself. Alex Thomas headed the office of the UK's most senior civil servant during the 2017 general election campaign.
The world doesn't stop happening during an election campaign, and so there is always the chance of the unexpected occurring, and sometimes that can be horrific crises, like in 2017, the Manchester Arena and the London Bridge terrorist attacks. clearly the first priority in any incident like that is to respond to it effectively, convene the civil contingencies apparatus in the Cabinet Office and to make sure that the government is doing everything possible for victims and the resilience of the country. But of course, during an election campaign, these things are then seen through an additional prism of intense politics. You know, I'm sure it weighed heavily on the Prime Minister and other ministers' minds during that campaign, how this would play out in terms of what it meant for policing and the debate around security. You know, Theresa May in that campaign obviously had a lot of experience as a long-serving former Home Secretary, so she could lean into that. But it did change the nature of the campaign, and I think first duty of the government is to keep people safe and secure, and that's a moment of high political jeopardy as well as of, you know, an incredibly important moment for the security of the country.
The joint pressures of governing and campaigning mean the incumbent party may not be as focused on preparing for the first days, weeks and months of a new term in office as they were when they came to power the first time. This can be particularly true when the polls are looking tight, as Kate Fall remembers from 2015.
First of all, we weren't so sure of the polls. In 2010, the polls looked like we might certainly be the largest party, if not win, which we didn't quite. In 2015, the polls were always the wrong way. So everything was geared on trying to get over the line and thinking about what would happen if we didn't and if we ate our coalition partners trying to win, which is exactly what happened, and where the room for manoeuvre was. So although we did, you know, we did have a plan, it didn't seem to me that we knew exactly what we were going to say or do. And of course, we were sort of half expecting to be in coalition. And I remember the moment in the gym where we were sitting, getting the election results in Witney with David Cameron. I was sitting next to him when we thought, actually, we've won a majority at sort of 3 a.m. David Cameron was going down to accept his Witney seat and all the cameras were there, and we suddenly realised that he would be expected to say something. And we're like, well, what's this all going to be? And it was a bit of quick work, I had to go into that speech.
But losing office can be brutal. Polly McKenzie remembers the aftermath of the 2015 election and the huge losses the Liberal Democrats experienced.
It was not the best day of my life. A bunch of us came in to the office. Paddy Ashdown gave a speech where he said, why would anybody ever try to do the right thing for the country in politics again? Which is, I think, just about how we all felt. Then we all traipsed up to where Nick, who had come down from Sheffield, gave his resignation speech. And we all cried a lot. And then we went to Walkers of Whitehall and we drank a lot. Don't remember the rest.
While governing parties have many benefits of incumbency going into an election, they also face many challenges, not just in managing the twin demands of governing and campaigning, but also in how to respond to the polls. Oliver Letwin's advice for those in government is that the challenges for the incumbent might sometimes outweigh the benefits.
We are now facing a situation in which the incumbent government has been around for more than 14 years, and I suspect that it will find it extremely difficult to do the kind of work that oppositions can do and that I see the Labour Party doing now in opposition while still trying to run the country and deal with the day-to-day business of government, which is extremely exerting. You have neither the bandwidth nor the freedom of manoeuvre that you might desire. And I think that puts incumbent governments at a significant disadvantage compared with oppositions, because instead of having the freedom to think politically and to work things through, they are bound by their own history and constrained by the demands of managing the government.
Thanks for listening to this episode, Preparing for Power, from the Institute for Government. In our next episode, we'll be taking a behind-the-scenes look at manifestos and how parties decide which pledges they want to take to the country. We'll be asking former politicians, advisers, and civil servants what a manifesto is actually for, their advice for parties preparing to write their own, and what ultimately makes for a successful manifesto. See you next time.